Everyone, and thank you, Paul, for this nice introduction. It's always a pleasure to be back in Hong Kong. And what I'd like to do this evening is I'd like to share with you some work that we've been doing for the past few years in the context of my group at Carnegie Mellon University. As Paul pointed out, the Internet of Things is upon us today, and it's creating lots of new opportunities in terms of smart homes, smart cars, smart cities, smart anything. And at the same time, it raises also some issues in terms of what happens to our privacy. When you think about all the data that will be collected in support of many of these scenarios, and what it will take for users to remain in control of that data and what happens to it, which is obviously the fundamental principle of privacy. So what I'd like to do today is I'd like to take a little twist on fact that a lot of people have been blaming artificial intelligence for many of the risks that they see associated with the Internet of Things, the idea that all these devices, these applications, these services that are increasingly finding their way around us are going to be collecting data that could eventually be mined and that could effectively feed into personalized assistants and all sorts of other types of intelligent functionality. I'd like to put a twist on this because a lot of people have been blaming artificial intelligence for many of these privacy risks. And I'd like to ask the question or turn things on their head, if you want, and ask to what extent those very same technologies that are often blamed for invasions of privacy could potentially be put to good use and help us, in many ways, remain in control of our data, in control of our privacy. So that's the question that I'm asking, and we'll try to see whether we are moving towards an answer to that question by the end of the presentation. The research that I'm going to be presenting today is in great part conducted in collaboration with two other universities. So this is what is probably the largest research project in the United States funded by the National Science Foundation in the area of privacy. I've been leading this project for the past 2 years. My collaborators come from the Stanford University School of Law, and the law school also at Fordham University. We at Carnegie Mellon provide, obviously, most of the technical expertise, including expertise in artificial intelligence, machine learning, natural language processing, crowdsourcing, and human-computer interaction. And we're trying to blend together these different perspectives to see what we can do in terms of empowering users to remain in control of their privacy in the age of the Internet of Things. And so, in this talk, I will try, and this might be a little ambitious, so I realize I might have to skip a few slides along the way, but hopefully you'll bear with me and I'll make sure to explain what I'm skipping at a level that everyone can hopefully follow. So my goal is to briefly reflect on privacy in the age of the Internet of Things. I'll talk about the concept of no decent choice, which is effectively the framework that we rely on when it comes to empowering people to remain in control over their data. The Usable Privacy Project is what obviously we're going to be talking about today, and I'll briefly outline the overall objectives of the project and then have time to describe everything that's been done in this project, but I'll try to highlight a few different results that have emerged over the past couple of years from this research, and that suggests that perhaps AI has, in fact, something to contribute in this space. So we'll ask ourselves to what extent we can crowdsource policy annotations, and I'll explain why this is an important issue. How can machine learning and natural language processing help with this process? And then we'll also ask, beyond just trying to develop technology that could help us automatically or semi-automatically understand privacy policies and what they mean about what happens to our data, to what extent can we also motivate users to pay attention? Because it's one thing to digest all this, but even if you provide them with very succinct interfaces and summaries of these privacy policies, this may not be enough yet to motivate people to review these policies, to make informed decisions, or to potentially configure settings. So those are the two things that I'm hoping to talk about this evening, and I'll tell you a bit more about ongoing research in our group beyond those results. So the Internet of Things, this is actually old in some ways. These are statistics that came from Cisco. Cisco, as you know, is obviously an organization that has all the right motivations for understanding where the Internet of Things is going and what sort of equipment would be required to connect all these different devices. According to Cisco back in 2011, they were projecting that effectively by 2020, this is just around the corner, at this point. By 2020, people on this planet would have, on average, somewhere between 6 and 7 devices. I'm willing to bet internet-connected devices. I'm willing to bet that a number of people in this room have already reached that point. Just think about it. Think about the number of cell phones that you have, and I'm talking about smartphones, number of tablets that you might have, web-enabled TVs, smart cars, perhaps some smart home appliances, if you've got a Nest thermostat at home. Before you know it, you realize that, or perhaps a game station of some kind or another, before you know it, you realize that you're probably actually past that stage already. So these statistics might be conservative, but they obviously also include people who don't have access to the internet, not just yet. And so what are we going to be doing with all these devices? Well, clearly, people have been thinking about many different scenarios to take advantage of this new ecosystem, if you want, that's being deployed. And many of these scenarios obviously imply that data will be collected about us as we engage in a variety of different activities where we interact with these services, with these applications, with these devices. The whole idea is that under many of these scenarios, we're going to try to personalize interactions that we have with the environment, because these devices can effectively be can effectively have computing and processing and communication embedded in them, and even actuation and sensing. Because of all that, the idea is we might be able to actually personalize many of our interactions with these devices. It's going to make effectively provide for more usable scenarios. It's going to provide for interactions that are more in tune with our needs, that are making us more productive and what have you. And obviously, as you collect a lot of data, as you engage with into various interactions with these devices, you've got to ask yourself, beyond all the potential benefits, be it in the context of your health, the context of energy, the context of traffic and transportation in cities, these are just pretty obvious examples that everybody's talking about, beyond those potential benefits, are there potentially also some risks? Some risks where effectively the data that you've made available to these services for a particular purpose gets reused in some manner in a way that perhaps you didn't expect and ends up creating a situation that you don't feel comfortable with. This is really what privacy is all about. It's about minimizing surprise. It's about minimizing regret that you shared data with a service that ended up using that service or making that data available to other services for purposes different than those that you expected. And it's very easy to think about many of these scenarios, as it turns out. So beyond just the obvious benefits and the number of scenarios that are being discussed these days, it's way too great for me to try and attempt to summarize those scenarios. But these ranges, just to take two, these ranges from, for instance, your thermostat at home, accessing your calendar to determine when you're going to be back home, to activate the air conditioning or perhaps the furnace, depending on whether you live in Hong Kong or in Pittsburgh, in time for you when you come back home. Right? Those scenarios sound very appealing. They might help save energy at home. This sounds good for the environment. This sounds good for your pocketbook at the end of the month. But who else is potentially going to get access to this data? And what else could potentially happen to this data? The same applies to healthcare scenarios. Obviously, everyone is thinking about, at some point, perhaps buying a smartwatch or an activity bracelet that will be recording a number of different types of data about your heart, from your heart rate to your blood pressure or what have you, potentially sharing that data directly with your doctor so that your doctor can then run some, can look at the data or potentially even run some algorithms on this data to diagnose different types of problems. All that sounds great if it's to improve your health. But what happens if that data gets shared also with third parties, like perhaps your health insurance provider, right? What happens if your premium increases as a result of that? What happens if you get denied health coverage as a result of that? Those are examples of privacy concerns that are real. Certainly in the United States, those things are very much part of potential futures. And it's very hard to find people who are entirely comfortable with the idea that somehow, as they were trying to take better care of their health, they ended up being denied coverage altogether. Right? And so how do we control this data so that it's being used for purposes that are aligned with our goals and it's not being used for purposes that we're not comfortable with. And so you might say, well, perhaps all we need is just an overall legislative framework that's going to ensure that nothing bad happens. Perhaps we should just have a law that says, well, your data should only be used for good things and it should not be used for bad things, or perhaps it should just amount to that. The problem is that we don't all feel the same way about these things. For instance, today in the United States, if you look, for instance, at auto insurance policies, there are auto insurance policies that offer you to share your data, your driving data, including the speed at which you drive and things of that nature, with obviously the understanding that if your data is good, your premium is going to be decreased. And obviously the understanding also that if your habits don't look too good, your premium could be increased. And so some people feel comfortable with that and others do not. Right? And so it's very hard to come up with default rules, default policies that will make everyone happy. It could stifle business. These insurance policies have done very well with some customers, but you could also, if you completely open the door and you don't provide some level of protection for customers, you could also create a situation where people end up very upset, and that's what we need to balance. So the concept of notice and choice is one that's found in most privacy frameworks, most legal frameworks. So here, for instance, in Hong Kong, we've got the Hong Kong Personal Data Ordinance or Personal Data Privacy Ordinance. And this enshrines, effectively, the concept of notice and choice. Right? So there are a number of different situations where a data collector has to inform you about their practices and has to obtain consent from you in order to engage in certain types of activities, certain types of data collection and processing types of activities. And the same can be found elsewhere, whether you're looking at the European Data Protection Directive, whether you're looking at the US in the context of a number of different privacy laws that we have in different sectors. So this is a fundamental approach that is found everywhere, and certainly when we're looking at the web, the way in which this is implemented in practice is in the form of a website privacy policy. So these website privacy policies that you see everywhere, perhaps, are intended to tell you what websites are doing, what information they're collecting from you, for what purpose, what they're going to be doing with it. They're going to be sharing that data with third parties or not. The same is true for mobile apps, right? So website privacy policies look like this. For instance, this is a high-level policy from Amazon, with each one of these subjects being something that you can click on to get potentially more information. And the same is true also in the case of privacy settings, right? So another dimension of notice and choice is that we're going to give you a number of different settings, because we cannot determine what people how people feel about different scenarios. Instead of forcing on them some particular default, we're going to give them options. Those options can come in the form of settings that you can configure. So your smartphone has many different settings, your browser has a number of different settings, if you have a Facebook account that has a number of different settings. So all those are examples. If you've got an iPhone, for instance, you have a privacy screen somewhere that enables you to determine which apps you're willing to share your location with, your contacts, your calendar, your reminders, and all sorts of other things of that nature. So this is effectively notice and choice. So that sounds wonderful. Perhaps the problem is solved. But maybe let me ask you a quick question, just to see how we're doing here. So how many of you have read a privacy policy over the past month? Do we have any heroes in the room? So not too many hands. Let me relax this. How many of you have read a privacy policy over the past 6 months? All right. And Charlie? Yes? And do you feel that you understood what you read?
No, well, I understand where they're trying to cover their bases, and I understand the parts that are sort of related to me, but then, like, the actual what it is that they're doing, not really.
So if you read a privacy policy, it must have been because you were potentially concerned about something in particular. After reading the privacy policy, were you able to determine whether your concerns were properly addressed?
I felt more reassured, but I feel like there may be loopholes or whatever I'm holding.
Okay. You sound a bit defensive, but I think you've answered my question. So even among the heroes here, those people courageous enough to read an entire privacy policy over the past 6 months, after reading that policy, you were not entirely clear that she understood what you had read.
But that's the same when you use the devices, like you said about the hard rate. Yeah? So how sensitive is it? So if you use different device, you can get the different results. So it's very vague term.
What is a vague term?
What the result you get of the analysis, because the input, the data you are collecting, it can be skewed because the device is not correct, or the terms in that policy, they are very vague, that you can interpret them in different ways.
So accuracy is not necessarily a or lack of accuracy is not necessarily a guarantee that your privacy is going to be protected. An example of lack of accuracy would be, for instance, a record that would be false that indicates that you declared bankruptcy. That's not accurate, hopefully for you, but it could be very damaging.
Yes.
So accuracy or lack of accuracy is not necessarily a guarantee that your privacy is being protected, although it certainly has something to do with privacy. So yes, there are many sensors out there. Your location, for instance, can be sensed, and it can be sensed with different levels of accuracy. If it's sensed at a very coarse level, what happens to that data is potentially less damaging than if it's a sense at a finer level and shared with the same third parties. That's absolutely correct. And a privacy policy, ideally, will tell you at what level it's collecting your location and whom it's potentially sharing it with and for what purpose. But as we just saw, in many cases, even if you're courageous enough to read a privacy policy, you may not be able to answer that question accurately. That's clearly a problem. Because these privacy policies were designed actually to inform you so that you could make an informed decision. You could decide whether or not to proceed with that particular website, whether to download that particular app on your cell phone. But if you cannot determine what happens to your data, what's being collected, for what purpose, then you're not in a position where you can make an informed decision.
I guess that's exactly the question. The majority of people, if you read the policy, you don't agree.
Yes. What next is a very good question. What next is a very good question. So could I, for instance, find another website just like it, but with a better privacy policy? Right. Well, how would you go and find such a website? Well, you would have to basically potentially Google for other services, start reading their privacy policy, and to the extent that you actually understand, this is my point. So to the extent that you spend the time reading all these privacy policies, to the extent that you actually understood what you read, then conceivably you would be able to make an informed decision and say, well, I don't want to go to CNN, I'm going to go instead to to the New York Times or what have you. Right? Nobody does that, right? So clearly the fact that all of you, among this entire room here, there's only two or three people who've read one policy in the past 6 months, clearly tells me that nobody does this on a regular basis. You're clearly accessing more than one website in a 6 month period of time. And I bet you that if you read these privacy policies and actually understood them, you would be very tempted to look for another website. But we don't have technology today that helps us do that. Right? So in fact, this concept of notice and choice is not practical. Right? On paper, people check a box, they have a privacy policy, but it doesn't amount to anything practical as far as we end users are concerned. And that's the point that I wanted to make. So I'm glad to see that I think we are all agreeing on this. So people are feeling pretty helpless, right? In fact, to put some numbers on this, reading a privacy policy, a typical privacy policy for an Alexa 1000 website is about 5 to 7 pages in length. Reading that takes about 10 minutes. And then if you do the math, right, and you look at the number of websites that you visit during the course of the year, and assuming that this privacy policy doesn't change during the course of the year, the privacy policies do change, but assuming that they don't, you'd be spending about 200 hours per year reading these privacy policies. And you would still be left wondering what you've read. So again, this is clearly not working. The same applies, so this is for the privacy policies. The same is true for settings. A good example that I like to use, as Paul mentioned, I'm heading the mobile commerce lab at Carnegie Mellon, so we do a lot of work on mobile apps in particular. A typical mobile app user has 40 to 50, if you're an Android user, you probably have more, 40 to 50 apps on his or her cell phone. These apps, on average, require something like three different permissions. Permission being a request to access sensitive data, like your location, your calendar, your SMS functionality. If you have an iPhone, if you're lucky enough to have an iPhone, which is among the two environments, Android versus iPhone, among the two environments is the one that gives you actually a bunch of settings. Right, so if you're lucky enough to have all these settings, you would conceivably have to configure as many as 120 settings. Right. How many of you have actually configured all these settings on the phones? I'm going to ask you that question later, so don't answer this yet. But this would be the second part of this presentation. So, because of this, right, because nobody is really able to find the time to read these privacy policies, and even if you were to read these privacy policies, you'd often still be left wondering what you've read, right? And there's nothing wrong about your reading skills, I can assure you. It's the lawyers who've been hired to write these privacy policies who are very good at effectively creating some wiggle room, right? And leaving some room for the company to actually modify some of the things that they do. So our project on usable privacy policies is a project we've been trying to see to what extent we could actually annotate privacy policies, effectively extract from privacy policies answers to the questions that people care about. What's interesting about privacy policies is that even though they're very long, very often, they often also do not address some important issues. And so by actually identifying the questions that people care about, so a person who reads a privacy policy, that person is not trained in reading privacy policy, they may not even realize that issues that are actually important to them are not being addressed whatsoever. Right? And so it actually helps also to say, well, what are the answers to these N questions that matter to people, including the ones that are not being addressed whatsoever? Right? Let's actually identify that these issues are not being addressed in privacy policy. So our objective in this project, when we started 2 years ago, was to see whether we could semi-automate the process of building annotations for privacy policy, effectively coming up with answers to a number of key questions that people care about, that ideally they would be looking for when they read these privacy policies, but they don't have the time to look for. And even if they did, they would not necessarily be able to come up with good answers on their own. Can we do that through crowdsourcing, effectively leveraging the wisdom of the crowd, as it's called? Think about Wikipedia, think about Duolingo, think about all sorts of other sites out there that have relied on crowdsourcing. Can we somehow, perhaps, enhance crowdsourcing with the use of artificial intelligence, techniques like machine learning, natural language processing? Could that potentially help us reduce the burden on crowd workers so that we don't need to find millions and millions of people who are willing to read privacy policies because we know that those people cannot be found? So can we develop then, after having identified these annotations, can we develop very simple user interfaces in the form of browser plugins that will briefly summarize the answers to a few questions that really matter to you. Most of the time, when you go to a website, there's only one or two questions that perhaps matter to you. You don't need to read, you shouldn't have to read 5 or 7 pages of text. But what I would like to do is I would like to tell you the answers to the two questions that matter to you specifically. And those two questions may be different than those that perhaps matter to somebody else, or those that matter to somebody else. So I would like to even change the information that I show you, depending on who you are, what you care about, what your privacy preferences are. So that's what we're trying to do in this project. Have we succeeded? Not yet, but we've got some good results. And that's what I'd like to share with you. So the objective is obviously fairly ambitious. This is a multi-year, multi-million dollar project. As I said, this is probably the largest project right now funded by the National Science Foundation in the United States. And it's about trying to combine machine learning, natural language processing, and crowdsourcing to annotate privacy policies by extracting useful information, answers to useful questions. And we then develop user interfaces that will effectively be aligned with the things that an individual cares about. So can we actually personalize the UI? And beyond that, if you're able to actually annotate policies in automated fashion, wouldn't it be nice to start automatically comparing website privacy policies across multiple sites? So that if you don't like the policy of one site, I can actually tell you about 2 other sites that have a policy that you would like better. Or how about informing regulators about the privacy policies found, for instance, on financial websites or healthcare websites, and how these policies are actually evolving over time. Are they getting worse? Are they getting better? very new types of practices that are being introduced. Right? So if you have the ability to extract all this information automatically or semi-automatically, you're actually in a position where you might be able to do that. Today, nobody is able to do that. There is every week, every year, there's 1 week that sees a couple hundred people who specialize in privacy do what people refer to as privacy sweep. So they manually inspect as many privacy policies as they can, keeping in mind that they can only read about a privacy policy every 10 minutes or so. So they do their very best, 200 people, you do the math, that's not a huge number of policies. And ideally, you would want to have multiple people reading the same policy to make sure that they're actually agreeing on the interpretation of these policies. So our goal is to try to completely change the picture in this area. And we believe that this is really critical because if this is already the state of affairs today, so with the fixed web and the mobile web, right, what is it going to be like when you have 7, 20, 50 devices that you're tracking on a daily basis? And this is not far-fetched. We're very close. The system statistics, we're dealing with the devices that you own, right? But we're in this room right now. There's a camera there that I don't own, but it's watching me, it's recording me. There's a microphone that's recording what I'm saying. You might very well be recorded too for it, right? When I was in the MTR, I'm sure there were various cameras that were looking at me. My Octopus card, I was also used to track information. Have I actually read the privacy policy of the MTR for the Octopus card? I have not. I understand that there's been actually some incidents and that there's been some statements in that policy that didn't seem to fully match what was actually happening in practice. So there are lots of interesting things here. And clearly, if this doesn't scale already with a fixed web, obviously this is going to scale with the internet. And so this chart here, I'm going to happily skip it, because if we're going to continue at this pace, we're never going to make it. So initially, one of the things that we did in this research is we tried to identify a set of questions that most people seem to be to care about. We effectively try to see to what extent we can, number one, get crowd workers to actually come up with answers to these questions for different privacy policies. Number two, to what extent we can actually improve the productivity of these crowd workers and their accuracy with artificial intelligence techniques like machine learning, natural language processing. So we initially focused on 9 questions. These 9 questions were the result of a number of interviews and looking at the sort of thing that people care about. So we focused on collection and sharing of data. Effectively contact data. This is known as personally identifiable information, information to contact you via email, by sending you something in the mail, the snail mail, your location, your health information, your financial data. Look at what these policies say about the sharing of that information. For each one of these questions, we also look at your ability to delete data that's been collected by website. Think about what happens to your data if you have an account on Facebook and decide to delete that account. Does Facebook actually erase all your data, or does it keep it? Does anyone know the answer to this question? Right. So, these are the kinds of things that people care about, and this makes a big difference. These questions are not trivial yes or no questions. There are actually questions where you can have a number of different options. And so the sorts of options that we look for instance, when it comes to sharing, you've got to ask yourself, well, is this site sharing my data in order to actually fulfill its core service? So for instance, when I order a book, for instance, on Amazon, right, and Amazon ships the book to me via UPS, it shares my contact information with UPS. Why does it share it? So that UPS can actually ship the book to me. Right? So that's sharing for core purposes, if you will. But if the same site collects information, for instance, about my interest, all the titles of books that I collect, and we sell that information, for instance, to my health insurance provider, because perhaps they're going to detect that I've got some kind of a health problem and might use that to hike my premium. That's a very different story. And so you want to distinguish between these things. Does the policy actually say something that enables me to tell the difference? Or does the policy potentially ignore this issue altogether, which is very often the case. Right. So we included in these questions options for crowd workers to indicate that the question was unclear or that the question was not addressed. Which is a way of effectively making up for the fact that if I were to read this as a customer, someone who's not necessarily completely up to speed on privacy issues, I may not even realize that this is an important issue because it's not addressed altogether in a privacy policy. By effectively having a fixed set of questions, having those sorts of answers as options for the crowd workers, we're trying to also capture a situation. Website basically attempts to basically ignore the issue, to gloss over coverage. So those are the kinds of things that we did. There's a lot more that we could talk about here. But effectively, we then ended up building an initial interface to enable crowd workers to then read privacy policies and to provide us answers to various questions. So in this case here, we see the number of times privacy policy, we can obviously scroll, and they go through these 9 questions here. But for each one of these questions, the information, they can click on some terms, if they're not sure about the meaning of these terms, they provide us with answers. We also collect a lot of information as we do that. So we ask them to highlight, for instance, text in the policy that they rely on to determine their answer to a given question. Why do we do that? Because that's very useful for machine learning, as it turns out. So you can effectively start effectively mining all these texts, see what text people rely on as they provide different answers. And obviously, that has been fed into different types of algorithms, and I'm going to share with you some results that we got from that. So, hopefully, we started working with Amazon Turkers. I don't know if all of you are familiar with Amazon Turk, so Amazon Mechanical Turk. So this is an environment that has effectively emerged over the past few years. It's a great environment for people, for social scientists, and people conducting all sorts of different experiments. You can effectively recruit people who are willing to work for a few pennies to carry out different tasks. These crowd work keep on the whole, although these days you've got to pay them $5 or $6 an hour, roughly, if you want to get quality work. Amazon Mechanical Turk actually enables you to select the people that you're going to recruit. We tend to recruit high-quality crowd workers. So we tend to recruit people who've got 95% accuracy in the tasks they've performed. These crowd workers are people who actually spend often several hours a day doing this. And many of them have been doing this for a few years at this stage. So there's an extensive record as to how well they've done on previous tasks, whether or not they're serious people. As you conduct these tasks on Amazon Turk, there are also some tricks and best practices that have been developed over the past few years. You want to make sure that your crowd workers are not just clicking randomly. So there are actually some very simple questions you can effectively insert into the process to make sure that they are awake and to make sure that they are reading what you're showing them. And you try to do all these things. So we're applying all these best practices. We've been doing these sorts of studies now for a number of years. And so the first question was, does crowdsourcing even work? And this was an important question because, as your colleague pointed out, even when she read the privacy policy, she was still not entirely sure that she had read it properly and that she really understood what that policy said. And so one might say, well, if that's true, then, you know, is crowdsourcing ever going to work, right? She's going to get all these people who are reading these privacy policies and they're not sure that they understand what they've read. You know, how good is it going to be to collect all this information in the first place? Are they going to convert onto anything meaningful? So one of the things we had to do as part of this research is we had actually used lawyers and law students to read privacy policies, annotate these privacy policies, and help build what people refer to as a gold standard. So we've got effectively a number of policies where we're in agreement as to what the policy says. And sometimes that agreement is in the form of saying the policy really doesn't say anything about X, or the policy is ambiguous about X. And that's the gold standard, right? And occasionally you can actually see the policy does say something and ambiguous. Yes, we collect your email addresses. And yes, we collect it for this record purpose. So we have a number of those policies that we've annotated. And then we proceeded with Amazon Turkers, right, crowd workers recruited for Amazon Turk. And we asked them to effectively complete the same questions, to answer the same questions, using the same interface that we've built. And so this is an example of results that we got from 26 privacy policies, 9 questions, 10 Turkers per policy. Effectively per policy and question pair. So the result that you're seeing here, so we had 198 question pairs. So these are basically policies and questions, right? So for a given policy, I'm trying to answer a given question. We had 198 question pairs for which we had a gold standard. Now, why is it that we only had 198? 26 policies and 9 questions. If you do the math, right? How many of you can do the math? 224. So there are basically 36 policy question pairs for which I don't have a gold standard. That means that even the lawyers, even the experts in privacy, could not agree on what these policies said. That's a problem in its own right, by the way. But I'm going to set this aside. for example. And so when we're looking at a crowd like this, what we did is we looked at a number of different studies, as you can imagine, but I'm just going to report here. Results where you get 80% of crowd workers to agree on a given answer. When you do that, these are the settings that you use, then effectively you end up being able to answer 75% of the, those numbers don't matter. I've done something wrong. Never mind. The percentages are the correct thing. So, surprised that nobody pointed this out, so I guess it's been a long day for some of you. But the percentages are what matters. So, 75% of the time, these crowd workers actually giving me the correct answer. What I was most worried about was this. How often do these crowd workers agree at 80% on the wrong answer? And the good news is that the answer is not too often. Actually, about 2% of the time, they're going to end up converging on the wrong answer. That's very, very good. If you lower the level of agreement, like if I go down to 60%, that percentage increases. It jumps to 8%. So we don't want to go there. We want to stay with 80%. And then, obviously, there are situations where the crowd workers do not manage to converge on an answer. So there are situations where the experts are better than the crowd workers. Now, experts agree, right, on 23% of the policy question pairs, but my turkers are not able to come up with the same answer. They're just not converging. They don't know. That's not too bad. Actually, if 75%, again, remember the amount of time it takes to read policies. Remember how many of you have read policies. If I can actually give you answers to 75% of the questions that you care about, and you don't have to read the policies altogether, that's a big win. Right? So that by itself was actually a very good result. Obviously, there's always a bug in these results, right? So the world is not such a pretty place, and things tend to be more complicated often than it seems. So even though these results look very good, it doesn't scale, right? So my crowd workers spent 20 minutes reading these privacy policies. And clearly, there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of website privacy policies I would like to read, right? And these policies are not fixed. Every so often, websites change their policy. So in 20 minutes per policy and 10 crowd workers per policy, I'm only going to go so far. So can I scale this up? Right? And so you might say, well, how about taking, why do you even need to crowdsource this altogether? Now that you've collected all this data from these crowd workers, could you apply some machine learning algorithms to this? And could you somehow actually come up with the answers automatically? Well, it would be nice. All right, so this is obviously with a number of different techniques, as you can imagine. We've tried lots of different things. I'm going to spare you the details. But by and large, even on the best questions, we're getting about 75% accuracy. Right? I would not, 75% accuracy is very different from answering correctly 75% of questions. Right? 75% accuracy means that basically, one part of the time, I'm going to end up with an annotation that's going to be incorrect. That's a little too high for comfort. And there are actually some practically tough questions. For instance, entities with which information may be shared. This is a very tough one. Sharing is where it gets very, very complex, as it turns out. I gave you the example of FedEx that's going to be sharing my contact information with UPS, for instance, which is very different from FedEx sharing, Amazon sharing my contact information with UPS versus Amazon sharing my reading preferences with, for instance, an insurance provider. Those are very different types of things, and it's very hard to actually automatically identify those differences today. So we believe we can probably do better over the years, but we're not going to fully automate this anytime soon. There might be a few questions where we might be able to fully automate it, but we're never going to get 200% of that, at least not in the foreseeable future. And so our approach is one that tries to effectively combine these two different perspectives. So crowdsourcing works, but it's obviously very time-consuming and doesn't scale very well. Machine learning seems to have some potential, but certainly I cannot rely entirely on it. So is there a way that I can marry these two approaches so that effectively I perhaps can find some ways of decomposing the problem where machine learning will do some of the work and the crowd workers will do the remaining of the work? Is there a way that I could do that? And so one idea is to see to what extent, instead of requiring a crowd worker to read an entire privacy policy, for a given question, I could potentially identify paragraphs within that policy. that pertain to practical question, and only show the crowd worker those paragraphs related to that practical question. If I could do that, there's potentially tremendous gain that should be obtained. To give you a sense for what I'm talking about, a typical privacy policy has something like 44 paragraphs on average. This is based on looking at thousands and thousands of privacy policies. So there are about 44 paragraphs. Would that, for instance, reduce the number of paragraphs that someone needs to read to 5 or perhaps even 10 paragraphs? Right? If I could do that, I could actually reduce the amount of reading that's required for my crowd workers by a significant amount. So can machine learning and natural language processing get you at least that far? And the quick answer is yes, actually. So we've had some very good results. Let me briefly summarize some things we've done. I'm going to sort of quickly go over some of these slides. I don't want to go too deep into some of the underlying technology. But what we've done, one of the first things we did, is we applied a technology known as hidden Markov models. And this is actually technology that has also been used for sequencing the genome very successfully. So we've looked at privacy policies a bit like genomes, and we've looked at different paragraphs in privacy policy and trying to see whether we can actually predict what a paragraph is, what topic a paragraph is addressing, and how these paragraphs are actually following one another. And there are natural flows. For instance, typically a privacy policy will tell you about information that it collects before it tells you who it's sharing that information with. Right? So that's a typical example. Right? I'm going to tell you what I collect, then I'm going to tell you what I do with the information I've collected, and who I share it with. And so those sorts of observations can actually be learned with hidden Markov models very successfully. So I'm going to try to make up for time here a little bit. But effectively, this is an example. So I'm taking here an Amazon policy, and these are two paragraphs that both relate to cookies. They're not exactly appearing one after the other, but I can actually recognize that these two paragraphs pertain to discussions relating to cookies, and I can actually look at the way in which these paragraphs are being sequenced fairly successfully. So when you apply hidden Markov models in this context, you can effectively compare privacy policies, Amazon, Walmart, eBay. You can find ways in which different paragraphs relate to one another. So I can say, for instance, the paragraph C in the Walmart policy relates to paragraph B and paragraph B in the Amazon policy. For instance, this could be an example of these cookies that I just showed you. I can actually do this. So we had to obviously train different models to do this. So there's also crowdsourcing that was involved in getting people to look at different paragraphs to tell us what was being discussed in these paragraphs. Are these paragraphs actually discussing the same thing or not? So doing descriptions of different paragraphs, asking people to look at these paragraphs and tell us whether or not, what are the things that are being discussed. For instance, here, you've got the discussion of choice and opt-out, here you've got the discussion of opt-out. So yes, these two paragraphs are actually dealing with the same types of topics. Crowd workers are actually pretty good at answering questions at that level. So this is again, and I'm sort of skipping over different things, but a big part of the work that you have to do in this space when you try to do crowdsourcing is find tasks that are basically at a level where they can actually be solved accurately and by crowd workers. So that's an example of a task that's not too complex for crowd workers. It doesn't take much time either. Right? It's very difficult to recruit people who are willing to spend 20 minutes of their time on a task. Much easier to recruit people to do a task like this, which takes basically less than a minute. So those are the kinds of things that we've been playing with. And so to make a long story short, and this was published, I think, this past August at a conference, but to make a long story short, when we applied these hidden Markov models here, we were actually able to get about 87% accuracy in terms of predicting what paragraphs are effectively relevant when it comes to different types of questions, different types of topics. And so the next step was to see whether we could use this technology to then build a variation of the interface I showed you earlier, where we would then highlight different paragraphs as we ask people, crowd workers, to annotate policies. So instead of showing them the whole policy and say, find the answer to this question, we'd show them effectively the whole policy, but would highlight actually those paragraphs that we identify as being relevant to that question using these machine learning techniques that I just showed you here. So when you do that, these are the kinds of results. So this is what the interface looks like. And notice, by the way, that so this may seem like I'm highlighting everything, but these are actually the top two paragraphs that are being shown here, I can then scroll, all of the text corresponding to this here is not being highlighted, then I highlight another two paragraphs, and then one more here above. And so everything else, basically the CRUD worker doesn't have to be. He's welcome to take a look at this if he wants to. And it's actually an interesting usability question as to whether a CRUD worker with an interface like this will still read the full policy, or whether he's actually going to limit himself just to the paragraph that you highlight. Those are effective things that machine learning cannot tell you. You actually have to experiment with real users and see how they behave. Right? But when you do these sorts of things, you're actually getting some pretty interesting results. So I'm going to just briefly summarize what you're seeing here. So what you're seeing are basically three different conditions where we recruited crowd workers. One with no highlights, one where we highlighted the top five most relevant paragraphs, highlighting different paragraphs for different questions. So this is still working under the assumption of 9 different questions for each policy, and the top 10 paragraphs. And what happens now is that effectively, if you're highlighting 10 paragraphs, right, keep in mind that this is out of typically 44 paragraphs per policy, so it's less than 25% of the text that you need to read, your accuracy actually goes up. So now they're getting 90% of the questions right. They're getting 3.3% of the questions wrong, and there are basically 6.7% of the cases where they're not converting. So I've effectively improved their accuracy, and I've also improved their productivity, because now I'm only requiring them to read a fraction of the text that they had to read before. So those are the sorts of results that we are getting in this project. There are a number of other things that we're doing that I've not had the time to discuss. So you can obviously start varying the number of crowd workers that you need for a given question. Why should you always have 10 crowd workers? If after recruiting 4 crowd workers, they all agree on the same answer, do you really need another 6 to be completely sure? Probably not. You can actually learn, right? You can actually learn when you don't need to recruit crowd workers. Also, should all crowd workers be treated the same? Not all crowd workers are equally good at answering questions. So why not keep your better crowd workers for the tougher tasks and use the crowd workers who are perhaps a bit less sophisticated but sufficiently good for the questions that are easier to answer. Right. And so these are the sorts of things that we're expanding with as we speak here to try to scale this up further. And again, this is all based on machine learning. This is all based on effectively trying to learn how good different crowd workers are, how many crowd workers you need to answer a question. We're also moving towards more organic questions. So the work that we had done last year, so everything that I described so far is what we did a year ago, the work that we did last year was based on, which was very useful. But one of the things that we've learned, in the sorts of things that people care about tend to vary quite a bit from one website to another. There are all sorts of new practices that are being produced all the time. And sometimes the sorts of things that people will really care about are very hard to predict unless you actually read the privacy policy. So we've effectively refined the crowd sourcing framework that I showed you a few minutes ago to allow people to organically identify questions. So now what they're doing is they're actually annotating paragraphs in an organic manner, picking from a very wide selection of keywords that we've identified and topics, if you want, that we know are potentially of interest. And we effectively look at each policy as its own thing to effectively come up with answers to different sets of questions. Beyond that, we're also planning, and so this is planned for Q1 of 2016, so just around the corner. Basically, we're going to no longer limit ourselves to crowd workers. We think that we should be ready, actually, by Q1 2016, to deploy a website and make it available to the public at large. Now, one of the things that we've discovered, you might say, well, who is ever going to want to come and effectively help you annotate privacy policy? So, surprisingly enough, even though Paul and I were talking about this a few minutes ago, many people are still not completely aware of the privacy risks that are out there as they interact with all these different technologies. There's a very rapidly growing group of people who are actually concerned about privacy and are actually willing to jump in their time. And you're seeing this through a number of different efforts. And so we believe that we're actually in the process of putting together a partnership with a number of key organizations in this space. We believe that we might actually be able to pull this off and get a meaningful number of people to come to the website. We want to make sure it's ready for prime time before we do that. So that's sort of the first part of the talk. We're also working on new types of browser plugins that try to summarize the questions. So this is an example of what is known as a privacy nutrition label, developed by one of my collaborators in the project. I'm not going to dwell on these things, but the idea is that I don't want to feed you back text and even long answers to questions. I want to sort of highlight things in different colors, get you to see really what's going on with a given website so that you can quickly determine whether or not you're comfortable with the policy of that website. We're also doing some studies looking at mental models. So as I said earlier, I want to highlight different things for different people. Like, in order to highlight things that are relevant for different individuals, I need to understand what they already assume about websites. There's no point in me telling you something that you already assume. I'm going to be wasting your time. So ideally, I'd like to know the things that would likely surprise you. And those are the things that I want to actually convey in my broader platform. I would like to tell you that maybe this website is doing something very unusual that you would not have expected. And that's the only thing perhaps I should tell you as far as using all these innovations that I've developed. So those are some of the things that we're doing in this space. And obviously, and I'm going to try to go fairly quickly here, probably because I think we're going to run out of time otherwise. The next question is, all right, you're doing all these things, you're annotating all these policies, right? Perhaps you're going to get there. Perhaps you will not, but assuming that you do, right, and assuming that you're building these broader plugins, are people actually going to pay attention to this? Are they going to necessarily act on this sort of information? And if not, what else could you potentially do? And so, to address this problem, which is, I think, a genuine problem, and I'm going to show you some results again in a few minutes that shows that this is truly an issue, to address this problem would be asking ourselves to what extent we can move away from effectively interactions with users where you roughly tell them everything you believe they should know before they start engaging with a given site or a given account. And instead, you try to move towards a much more interactive model for working with the user, where you effectively try to tell them about things that are likely to surprise them and use this as a way of nudging them and motivating them to review settings and to review decisions that they've made. And the work that we've done in that space is much closer to the work that we're doing at the Mobile Commerce Lab. It's work looking at mobile app privacy preferences. So many of you, if you've got an iPhone, have noticed that you have a screen somewhere that enables you to look at different permissions requested by apps that you've downloaded on your phone. You've got the ability to toggle these permissions. So you might say, well, Google Maps has the right to see my location now. Angry Bird should not have access to my location. This app can see my calendar. This other app cannot see my contacts list. This app can have access to my camera, and so on. As I pointed out earlier this evening, if you look at the number of permissions that you've got to configure within these environments, that number is already very large. So this is an example of a screen that was made available at some point by Android, and it might potentially be reintroduced. We'll find out what Google announces tomorrow at Google I.O. There are some rumors that it might be reintroduced, actually being removed since it was available. But effectively, those are examples of screens where you can see all the different permissions that are being requested by different apps. You can potentially toggle these things on and off, just as you would do, for instance, with an iPhone. And so, my question to you, as I announced earlier, was, you know, how many of you know what mobile apps you currently have running on your smartphone, right, and what information these apps are collecting? Please raise your hand if you do. I'm really impressed. So, three people? You know exactly which apps are running on your phone? Can we verify that? So what's the answer? You're killing all the apps all the time? That's what I do.
Limited memory.
Limited memory, okay, that's another one. Okay. Right. The vast majority of the people, and there are obviously some exceptions for weird reasons, the vast majority of people do not know what apps obviously they've got on their phone and have no idea what information is absolutely. And this is just a reflection of how complex this problem is of managing all these different settings. Right? So what would it take to actually get users' attention, right, and to get them to modify their settings in a way that would be more aligned, better aligned with the way they feel? Right? And people care about these things, by the way. So this is a chart. I've probably shown this chart last year. But this is a chart that shows how people respond when you tell them what their apps are actually doing. When you tell them, for instance, that Angry Bird collects their location, many of them are very smart, they just didn't know. And this is true for many others. So the work that we did is work where we decided to move towards this more interactive format that I described. We tell people, did you know that you have, that for instance, your apps on your cell phone have been sharing your location this many times with this many apps over the past 24 hours? Those are the kind of things that you would do. And so we actually hacked into Android to be able to do that. And we got some very interesting results. Right, so we conducted a study, this was done last summer. We conducted a study over a period of 22 days with 23 Android users. These users were using their regular cell phone. They had a bunch of different apps on their cell phones. And we effectively, in the final week of the experiment, ran this process of popping up nudges, as we call them. These are basically pop-up messages that would tell them, this is what's going on your cell phone. Are you okay with this? And if you're not, would you like to potentially modify your settings? And these were the real apps that they had. This was sort of conducted in the context of their real apps. So during the 3 weeks, the first week was just a baseline. We're just observing what they were doing with no intervention on it. In the second week, we gave them what is known as a permission manager. This is similar to what you have on your iOS phone, those privacy settings that I showed you earlier, where you can toggle things on an app-by-app basis. But that's all we gave them. So this is similar to what iOS users have on their iPhones. This is similar to what Android users had for a short period of time. And this might very well be reintroduced by Google to try to find out. The final 8 days of the study were obviously the ones we wanted to see to what extent we can get users to be more responsive to what, and to be more motivated to modify their settings. And this is where we would pop up one message per day, only one message per day. So over 8 days, we popped up a total of 8 messages. We focused only on 4 different resources that are considered to be very sensitive: location, calendar, SMS, and calendar. So let me show you what happened during the course of this study. So perhaps so that you better understand what's going on. And these are real numbers, right? So this is what a pop-up message would look like. So did you know your location has been shared 5,398 times with Facebook, Groupon, GoLauncher, etc. over the past 14 days? And then you would give them these 3 options. Let me change my settings, show me more before I make changes, keep sharing my location. Right? So this is, we would have one of those per day, right, for a total of 8 days. That's all we did. This number is, Peter, I said that this is a real number, 5,398. Actually, this became the title of the paper we wrote about this. We picked that title as we were going, and then as we compiled more statistics, we realized this was actually a fairly low number, and many of the other users had even higher numbers. We got a lot of press coverage when that paper came out, that high field. Saw some of the articles that came out.
Why 8 days, not 7 days?
Why 8 days? Because we needed basically a multiple of 4. So we created a week of 8 days. So that was the reason. And so if they decide to click and change their settings, these are the types of interfaces they will see. So for instance, here you can see that your location has been shared quite a bit. And then you can go on and you can effectively change the settings for these other apps. Right. So what happened, right? I'm going to skip a few slides again, as I said, but this is a brief summary, and hopefully you're not colorblind like I am, but I've explained this slide a few times, so hopefully you'll be able to follow what's going on. So what you're seeing here are, this is week 2, so it starts on day 8, and goes on through week 15, and these are the final 8 days of the study. So during week 2, what we did is we gave these people a permission manager. This is similar to the settings you've got in your iOS phone, where, as I said, you can toggle your permissions on and off for different apps. You can say this one can see my location, this one cannot. And what you see here in different colors are basically interactions. So along the vertical axis, you've got the 22 participants in this study. And here along the horizontal axis, you've got each one of the days. Right, so we're starting on day 8, going to day 15, and then to day 22. And this color here represents the user opening the permission manager, and this is the user restricting a permission. That means effectively preventing an app from accessing a given permission. So as you can tell here, during the second week, where there were no nudges, people were actually fairly engaged initially. So they actually modified they went to the number of their settings and restricted the number of their settings. We also made a lot of noise about this because Google had actually removed this functionality from Android. And they've actually been funding a lot of my work, so I was able to go and present this to them, and it seems like it has had an impact. So we might get an announcement next few days, as far as I understand, but I cannot say more. So they clearly realized that having a permission manager was important. What Android currently offers users is clearly not sufficient. But this is obviously what's more interesting. This is what I want to spend more time on. So after a whole week of having access to this, if you notice, the level of activity tends to go down over time. So by and large, most of these users have taken a look, and by this point in time, they feel that they're pretty much okay. They don't feel like spending more time configuring their setup. When you start nudging them, you pop up these daily messages saying, this is what's really happening. There's a whole new level of activity that pops up. I'm not going to go into all the colors here, but it should be pretty clear to you that people are responding to these nudges. Even though for a whole week they had access to functionality to modify their settings, and most of them had taken advantage. So most people didn't realize what was really going on. And we really met with these nudges to motivate them to take another look. And they ended up actually deciding that they were not satisfied with what they had done earlier. So the nudges make a big difference. I've got lots of slides here, but I'm not going to bore you with details. I'm going to just happily jump to one slide in particular. So as I said, the nudges focus on four different permissions: location, contacts, calendar, and call logs. And obviously, this is during week two. A number of these permissions were being restricted. And in fact, as people would restrict these permissions, they would see the other permissions in these apps were requesting. They would say, oh, but that's not right either. So they would modify things like camera, SMS, notification, recording audio, and also plugins. And so what happened in week three is, again, very similar. So week three, the final 8 days, right? We saw actually people restricting or reviewing their permission 69 times. So this is for a total of 23 participants. 47 distinct apps saw restrictions. And let's see, we're seeing 122 permissions. So quite a bit of activity, as I pointed out, and I also showed you with the graphic that I had earlier. So why did they do that? Well, by and large, they didn't feel comfortable with what these apps were doing. They realized there was a lot more sharing than they had figured initially. And if you look at these results in more detail, you really see that the nudges were the primary trigger for people to revisit their settings. So this was very successful, and I'm not going to bore you entirely with the details, but I'd like to get to the conclusion. I'd like to try to answer the question that I asked in the title of this presentation in the first place. So one of the points I wanted to make in this presentation is that notice and choice, which is the de facto approach to dealing with privacy today over the web, the fixed web, the mobile web, the Internet of Things, is broken. We all agree that nobody reads privacy policy, even when you read them, you don't know what they mean. So there's a very major problem here. As we move in particular to the Internet of Things, how do we fix this? And clearly, if we're going to fix that, I think that just working on better user interfaces per se is not going to cut it. I think there's a need to understand what people are capable of doing. Right? So it doesn't take much work to realize that you're placing the expectations way too high if you're assuming that people are going to read privacy policy. Right? But beyond that, if you want to figure what sorts of plugins you want to have in your browser, what sort of information you need to make available to users for them to actually act upon that information, that requires a lot of expertise in human-computer interaction, understanding what is effectively going to enable people to make meaningful decisions, which is the whole idea behind notice and choice. How can I provide users with the information that they need so they can make an informed decision and not take too much of their time? People are probably only willing to spend a fraction of a second, or perhaps a couple of seconds, as they move from one website to another. If you enter this room, right, in the age of right. There's a camera, there's a microphone, there are a bunch of other devices. Each one of you might potentially be sensing my phone if I have, by mistake, left Bluetooth on, for instance, on my phone. So there's a lot going on, right? And I don't know what your privacy policy might be. Right? So if I want to be able to cope with that, right, I've got to come up with a solution that's much more scalable. And what I believe is that ultimately artificial intelligence, which is contributing to obviously many of the challenges that we face with in terms of privacy, can also contribute to effectively helping us digest what these privacy policies say and help us configure many of the privacy settings that are being disclosed to us. So what I tried to do this evening is I tried to provide you with a glimpse of some of the work that we're doing in this space, show you some promising results. We're far from being done with this work. I'm sure it's going to take us many more years. But that's in a nutshell what I want to discuss with you. And I should probably acknowledge all the funding that we received. Yes, we've had a good amount of press coverage also. And this work has been funded, as I said, by the National Science Foundation, Google and Samsung. And there are too many collaborators here to mention, but you can find all their names on our website. So thank you very much.